Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Robert Baer, a veteran CIA operations officer who served in the Middle East. He will analyze the hopeful changes underway as the Arab Spring has the Assad regime in Syria teetering and the Revolutionary Guards regime in Iran alarmed by events in Syria and increasingly paranoid about their own restive population. However, all hopes for change could be dashed if, as senior Israeli intelligence officers warn, the Netanyahu government will likely attack Iran, leaving the compliant and supine superpower, the United States, on the wrong side of history. Then Roger Morris continues the conversation about hopeful change amid the death rattle of empire. He served on the senior staff of the National Security Council and has just completed a history of U.S.-Afghan relations and covert activity in South Asia, Between the Graves. He will also discuss the assassination of Karzai's brother Wali, the governor of Kandahar, who was monumentally corrupt and widely despised. May he rest in peace. Then finally, we will speak about the real state of the American economy overshadowed by political gamesmanship between one party that apparently will be rewarded for wrecking the economy and the other that will be punished at the polls for the resulting wreckage. David Ruscio, professor of economics at Notre Dame University, will sort through this train wreck and assess how fast the United States is becoming a plantation economy. I am now joined by Robert Baer, a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle East countries, including Iraq and Lebanon. He is the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, a husband and wife true life spy story. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
Ian, it's great to be here.
And events in Syria, as I mentioned in the opening, it does seem that the Arab Spring has the Syrian Assad clan, the Alawite regime there, teetering. It seems like the United States played a very helpful role, in as much as the U.S. ambassador and the French ambassador went to Hama and joined the demonstrations, which I think prevented the Syrian government from murdering thousands of their citizens in a demonstration that had about 100,000 people in the streets. Then, of course, the Syrian thugs attacked the U.S. embassy and the French embassy, orchestrated and egged on by Syrian state TV, leading the Secretary of State not to cut ties with Syria, but to say that the Assad had lost all legitimacy. I take it that the U.S. doesn't want to play into the regime's hands by meddling. That's probably why they haven't cut bait, because obviously the regime is blaming everything on Israel and the United States.
Well, I served in Syria, and it was a pillar of American foreign policy that we didn't like the regime. We never did like it, didn't trust it. But the alternatives were so awful that we were going to support it, at least not undermine it. The CIA never had any sort of covert action against the Syrian regime. It stayed away from the Syrian opposition. So for Hillary Clinton to come out now and say that the regime has lost its legitimacy is an enormous change for the whole region. That doesn't mean the Alawites are going to fall or there's going to be a coup d'etat. We just don't know that. But we've really, in this, crossed the Rubicon because we do not know what's going to follow the Alawites. They're a small percentage. They control the country through the military and the security services. The other Muslims in the country, the Sunni Muslims, don't consider them legitimate Muslims. They believe in the Trinity and all these very odd things. And they are at the opposite end of the spectrum of Osama bin Laden. Now, the Syrians are saying that the Muslim Brotherhood will take over and you will have an Islamic Republic there. Washington clearly does not buy this line.
Well, in your latest book, The Company We Keep, that you wrote with your wife, Dana, you talk about how you had a clandestine meeting with a Syrian general. And it seems to me that that would be the indication of the end of the Assad regime, is when the army cracks. And clearly, army officers and enlisted men have a terrible choice between killing their fellow citizens and fellow Syrians or being shot in the back of the head by the security people. So you've got the Bashir's younger brother Maher running the security forces, but most of the Syrian army, I understand, is locked down in their barracks, and they're only using Bashar's thugs.
They're using the Alawites. I mean, that's always been the case, that the elite divisions and the security services with real power are Alawites. There's no division in Syria that can move out of barracks without the permission of an Alawite officer. So if you have a colonel in command of a regiment, you will have an Alawite second command actually controlling it. Now, how that army will break up into pieces, I can't tell you, but it would clearly be along sectarian lines. The Sunnis, which represent about 65% of the country, would simply desert from the military, and leaving these elite units to fight, and it would be a civil war.
Well, of course, that the portent of a civil war and what happened next door in Iraq, thanks to George W. Bush's regime, is the glue that's holding the Syrian regime together, and that's why people are not joining. The entire population is not joining the protests.
You're absolutely right. It's a mirror image. We're going to get a civil war if the country cracks up. And just like Iraq, no one I saw in writing or ever has predicted the way that would break up, the way it did. And it's clearly broken up into sectarian divisions. And the same thing will happen in Syria. And the chances of it not spilling across the border into Lebanon are remote. It's another country that has these sectarian divisions. And it's so odd for most people for most Americans, it's very difficult to get their mind around the way the Middle East is made up, these kind of primeval divisions.
Again, let me remind the audience, I'm speaking with veteran CIA officer Robert Baer, who the movie Syriana was based on him, the character that George Clooney played, and written a number of books about the Middle East. We're talking in a broader context, though. I just did a UCLA Hemmer Forum the other night with two of the organizers of the Egyptian Revolution in Tahrir Square, and they said with absolute confidence that the Arab Spring will bring about the end of the Syrian regime, all of those corrupt regimes in the Middle East and in the Gulf, and eventually the Saudi regime as well. So, do you accept that notion of the march of history?
I certainly hear that from smart people in the Middle East that live there and know it and can think their way through problems. They are all saying that none of these regimes will be around by 2013 or 2014. What they have to go up against, of course, is the military in Syria, the military that controls the street. Egypt is the same way. Even Saudi Arabia, the National Guard, is the Praetorian Guard in that country, which keeps the royal family in power. And likewise, even Iraq, it's the military that's holding it. In as much as the country's being held together, it's the military that's holding it together. And, of course, we have Iran. It is the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which controls the street. So what we're going to have to see before these changes come about is the crack up of the military. You're going to have to see officers defect, units defect, and then we'll know it really is the end. But until then, it's going to be difficult to predict.
But clearly, the United States should be on the right side of history, and we have had ambivalence towards some of these. Or in the case of Tunisia and Egypt, we were a little late to act. And in the case of Bahrain, we took the Saudi side against the people. My understanding, and this is one of the reasons I called you, is that I've been following statements from the former head of Mossad in Israel, Maya Dagan, along with the former head of military intelligence, General Ashkenazi, and the former head of Shin Bet, the internal security FBI equivalent in Israel, all of whom have gone on the record in the Israeli press warning the Israeli people that Netanyahu, who's getting paranoid and isolated, is likely to attack Iran and do so soon.
Well, I don't think this is a bluff. As much as I know about Israel, this is not the way it works when a regime bluffs. forcing the Iranians to doing something, saying there's going to be an attack. I think that what this tells us with near certainty is that Netanyahu is planning an attack. And as much as I can guess when it's going to be, probably be in September before a vote on a Palestinian state. And he's also hoping to draw the United States into the conflict. And in fact, there's a warning order inside the Pentagon to prepare for a conflict with Iran. It's not saying we're going to initiate hostilities, but it could deteriorate to the point an Israeli attack, let's say the scenario would go on Natanz, a couple other nuclear facilities, to degrade their capabilities. The Iranians will strike back where they can, and that would be in Basra, Baghdad. We have diminished troop presence there. We're already seeing the special forces are starting to look at Iranian targets in Iraq and across the border, which we would strike back. And what we're facing here is an escalation, not a planned out-and-out war.
Well, the new Secretary of Defense has just been in Iraq, and he has warned about the extent to which Iran is already pouring arms across the border. And obviously, the U.S. is vulnerable both in Iran, in Iraq, and in Afghanistan, and not to mention Hezbollah, which is an Iranian surrogate.
Absolutely. And the Iranians are paranoid, as you said, and they're worried about, you know, what the reaction, what's happening to their country economically and in terms of oil and in the oil embargo and other sanctions. And so what we're going to see is there's going to be a proclivity on their part to respond with force. And it's a nightmare scenario because we simply don't have enough troops in the Middle East or enough soldiers to fight a war like that. And I think this, we're really truly looking into the abyss. The good news is that we look into the abyss, but rarely do we go over the edge.
Well, but
there's not much hope, I know.
But Robert Baer, the thing that's just astounding about this is that just as there's some hopeful change underway in that region, in a way that could bring about a whole new era. And of course, to some extent, I think we've underestimated, in a kind of racist way, the Arab desire. As you hear in these demonstrations from the young people leading the Arab Spring, they talk about dignity, dignity, dignity. We've been caught by surprise, but everything that's hopeful would be dashed. And Netanyahu would turn back the clock, and that's why I can't understand why the United States, and particularly the military, aren't already weighing in and warning and saying to the President Obama, for God's sake, you've got to stop this.
The military is. The military rarely encourages wars. I mean, the problem with the military is once they're in them, they have to say we can win them, and they have to say we're winning. But the military is certainly aware of the Iranian problem and what we would face in a conflict. But the president is up for election next year. You've got Israel, which is truly out of control when it comes to doing something about Iran. They just interpret it as an existential problem, and they have to react now, or else. They think the Iranians are going to go right up to tighten the last screw on a nuclear warhead, and should there be some sort of other conflict the Israelis couldn't control, the Iranians are crazy enough to use a bomb. Now, that's their interpretation, or at least inside the Likud it is. And they also feel that if they give up on Palestine, the 67 borders, they will also suffer a huge defeat. I mean, if they go back to the 67 borders, at the narrowest point, it's only 10 miles across Israel, and they say those borders are not defensible.
As you know, and you worked with these people, Maya Dagan and Tzipi Livni and the former...
Well, Ashkenazi, the chief of staff. I mean, Keep in mind, these are all people who understand Iran and know it very well.
Right, but they're going on the record. I mean, we don't read this in our press, which is an absolute disgrace. But there's a vigorous debate going on in Israel where these senior officers are going into the press and being censored by army intelligence, army censors, trying to tell the Israeli people that their prime minister is crazy.
It'd be the same thing if it happened here. I don't know why we're not paying attention. If the generals all resigned en masse and said that our president was crazy, I would pay attention. But I've certainly paid attention to Israel, and I think if I were forced to bet, I'd say we're going to have some sort of conflict in the next couple months, unless this is just a masterful bluff. And I can't believe the Iranians would succumb to it, but I think the chances of it being a bluff are remote.
Yeah, but then why would the Iranians succumb to it, Bob? Because they will benefit from it, for God's sake. This is an illegitimate regime, paranoid about its own people, on the wrong side of history. I mean, this is a gift.
No, you're exactly right. The Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps needs an external enemy because we've left Iraq. It's no longer the United States that's the enemy, so it's become Israel. But in order to make this threat believable, they would love an attack on their nuclear facilities. And they would love to go to war in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia and Iraq and hit us where they could, simply because their defense is asymmetrical. I mean, we could take out all of their armored units, and it's of little difference to them, or their surface-to-air military sites. It's of little difference. Because they would be able to use, you know, what we call terrorism, or, you know, these irregular forces, which they are very good at, by the way. They would do serious damage to our fleet in the Gulf.
So I'm just puzzled here, just in the last couple of minutes, Robert Baer, about the President of the United States presumably is getting these kind of briefings. I mean, he must be told about what the former head of Mossad and the chief of staff in Israel are warning their public about. What you think he's basically helpless because of this next year being a political year, and he'd just have to go along with it and join the war? I mean, I presume what would happen is the United States would be forced to join this insanity on Israel's side.
We would be forced to do it, and I think the real question is what happens when you see, you know, 100 F-16s approaching Iraq, and there's a call to the White House and saying, you know, we're going in. You know, we're at war with Iran. What does the President of the United States do? And we have little influence over Bibi Netanyahu or the military. It just, you know, we can't stop them. And they know it. And what they're hoping is that the Iranians will react against us because we are the ones that are closest and that they can get to. You know, this isn't a multiple choice question where there's one right answer on what to do about this.
Well, I'm sure many people in the audience and our listeners are thinking that we're blowing smoke here. But again, we're citing people that are at the top tiers of Israel's intelligence and military establishment. And
Ian, we've seen this. You know, Cheney was thinking about going into Syria in 2003 and 2004, just continuing right from Baghdad. I mean, and there was serious talk in the Bush administration of attacking Iran. I mean, they talked about this. So, I mean, this is reality.
Right. And then just in closing, then, I just wanted to refer to the breaking story of the assassination of Karzai's brother, Ahmad Wali, in Kandahar. Do you think that's going to affect, could it get any worse in Afghanistan?
To say we're winning in Kandahar, that we've got the situation in hand, that there's great progress, I think that this assassination just belies that completely. I mean, he was the man holding it together, as corrupt as he was. He was a warlord, and he held the place together, and he was our ally, and now he's gone, and I'm not sure who replaces him, and no one else is either. It's a setback.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Robert Baer.
Thanks.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Baer, who's a veteran CIS operations officer who served in Iraq and Lebanon, among other places. He's the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, dealing with the new Iranian superpower. And his latest book with his wife Dana is The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Spy Story. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the assassination of Karzai's brother with Roger Morris.
سمعت هالشباب يما الحرية عالباب يما طلعوا يهتفوا له شافوا البواريد يما قالوا اخوتنا هن ومش رح يضربونا سمعت هالشباب يما الحرية
And welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Roger Morris, who served on the United States in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His new book, Between the Graves, is about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia based on thousands of previously secret documents. He's also at work on a comparative history of the inner politics of the United States and Soviet Russia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Morris. Roger, you there?
Yes, I am.
Welcome to Background Briefing. And were you able to hear Bob Baer?
Yes, and I certainly agree with him. I think this is a very serious moment in American relations with Israel and the danger of an attack on Iran. I think that's it's very serious indeed.
And it's not a bluff. In other words, I mean, how could we be so passive in the face of something that we know is it will be a manifest disaster and will turn back the clock and put us on the wrong side of history?
Well, I think if one looks at the 60-some year history of Israeli foreign policy interacting with the United States, really since at least since the late 40s, early 50s, the Israelis don't bluff. I think Bob is right. I think this is a serious step. It's motivated in part by what's happened in the Arab Spring. I think there are two factors at work here. One, the prospect of democracy in the Arab world is a nightmare for the Israelis. It means that they have no real cooperation, as they've always had, under the table or over the table, with the despots who have generally ruled in the area. That's been a sine qua non of Israeli foreign policy, after all, and it's what the Americans secured by a separate peace with Egypt in 1978-79. The other factor about the Arab Spring, and I think this is equally important, is that they have watched the equivocation of the Obama administration, a series of temporizing measures and steps and statements. Clearly, Washington was confused, caught off guard, did not have a contingency policy ready, was at best ambivalent about losing its own client dictators in the area, especially Mubarak. And Egypt has always has been the linchpin of American policy, either as a hostile country as it was under Nasser, or as a furtive ally as it was under Mubarak, and of course beginning with Sadat. So these two factors, the equivocation of the Obama administration and the danger that Arab democratization eventually poses for Israel, I think pushes Netanyahu in the direction that he's always gone anyway, which is a very belligerent, hostile stance toward the Iranians, and I think he sees his own
his own political fortunes tied to that, as well as believing that, as Bob said, that somehow the Iranians on producing a nuclear weapon will throw the switch and use it.
So just to deal with the Arab Spring part of this scenario, the hopeful part of it, as opposed to the nightmare, do you accept Bob's notion, and it was reflected by the two guests I had recently at the UCLA Hema Forum, two of the organizers of the Egyptian Revolution, that the Arab Spring is spreading everywhere. It's inevitable that these regimes will go, and probably will go soon.
Well, I think it's inevitable. I think it's the single most hopeful development we've seen in the Middle East, really since the fall of the Ottoman Empire, and maybe even further back. I think there's a very serious question about the timing of all of this. I'm not sure that I agree with Bob that or his informants that this is all going to happen in the next 2 or 3 years. Obviously, all of these regimes are different. What's happening in Syria is one thing. What would happen in Saudi Arabia is quite something else. I don't think that this is going to be a rapid or hurried process, but I do think it's inevitable. I think that, again, Egypt, Tunisia, of course, was the spark, but Egypt, I think the great Arab culture, the great Cairo is still the great Arab city, I think had enormous symbolic importance. And the emergence of a more democratic regime, and that will be slow, too, in Cairo in coming, the emergence of a democratic Egypt with a more independent democratic foreign policy, and that foreign policy inevitably more pro-Palestinian, more activist. They've already lifted the gate in Gaza, which I think had to have set off all sorts of alarms for the Israelis. The Israelis cannot sustain over time a democratic Arab world on their borders, and they are isolated drastically as it is. They're facing this vote in the United Nations, which they're going to lose for all intents and purposes, whatever the American veto achieves. They'll lose that vote on Palestinian statehood, and I think that, again, has enormous symbolic importance.
So the turning back the clock, as Netanyahu's attack on Iran would be, there's I suppose in that context it sort of sounds logical, even though it will be a disaster for the United States.
It'll be a disaster for the United States and in the long run for Israel, but I think this is really, Ian, a roll of the dice, a great gamble. I think the Israelis have a doomsday approach to international affairs as it is. We've known that for some time, and I think they reckon that they can change the landscape of geopolitics in the region and in the world. They feel they did that in the 1967 war. I was there in the White House in 1967. I saw the way the administration reacted to all of that, the run-up to the war, and we're going to see a similar reaction, I think, in the Obama administration. This could be stopped, as Bob suggested, by something categorical, by the president acting in a categorical way, but that's highly unlikely. His habit here, his tendency is to be ambivalent and to temporize in these matters. He's surrounded, of course, as you well know, by what I would call effectively a kind of sixth column, if not a fifth column of active agents, a sixth column of people who are so sympathetic to the Israelis as to shut out serious consideration of another policy. And that's not just Dennis Ross, the Israeli lobby sort of revolving door bureaucrat who is the head of Middle Eastern Affairs and the NSC, and not just Vice President Biden, who is a legendary servant of the Israel lobby, but also the new National Security Advisor, Tom Donilon, who has a long history of being very pro-Israeli inside the government, back to his days as a staff man for Warren Christopher in the Clinton administration. And you have a new factor here, a joker in the deck, as it were, a new Secretary of Defense in Leon Panetta, who I think has always been, certainly in the Congress and to the extent that he had a voice in the Clinton years, very much a hawk on the Middle East, and there's no reckoning here of anyone of any authority inside the Obama administration who's going to put the brakes on this. And so I see Bob's scenario being played out. I think the president will have no choice but to basically acquiesce in an Israeli attack. And from the point of view of the Iranians, we know, Bob is absolutely right, it is an asymmetrical strategy, and we know that they will hit us. They will hit us where it hurts. They'll hit us with a declining troop force in Iraq. They'll hit us in the Persian Gulf. They will certainly respond in Lebanon and elsewhere throughout the Middle East. This is going to be a nightmare. It's going to play havoc with oil, and it's certainly going to be a major factor in the America's immediate economic future, which is none too bright as it is. I don't see this being anything but a short and long term disaster for the Obama administration politically. I think there are already signs out there which are not very encouraging. He's got very, very weak and wan opposition from the Republicans, but his own base is certainly lacking in enthusiasm. There's a lot of disillusionment. There's a lot of desertion in the ranks, both in financial terms and in terms of sheer volunteer bodies out there. This is not 2008 by any stretch. And so the president's got a very difficult political calculus here, and it's sort of a no-win if he really leans on the Israelis and stops this disaster. He runs the risk of the lobby retaliating as only they can do with a massive effort that could end up electing a Republican who would be almost reflexively a pro-Israeli. So it's from Obama's point of view, it's not a good choice.
So I guess Roger Morris, again, has served on the National Security Council and in the U.S. Foreign Service, on the senior staff of the National Security Council. The absence of Robert Gates, I mean, Gates would make a difference if he was still there. And I understand the U.S. military have made their feelings clear that when Dick Cheney was talking about attacking Iran, not to mention Syria, the U.S. military apparently weighed in. So surely they're weighing in behind the scenes.
There's no question that they are, and I hate to say this. I think our generals, who have been for the most part, I think, irresponsible in the conduct of the wars in Iraq and in Afghanistan, may be our last best hope here. It would have been much better if we still had Bob Gates, for all his faults and flaws in the record. I think he was adamantly opposed to supporting giving any kind of green light to the Israelis. The problem with dealing with the Israelis is that it's almost a nightmare scenario based upon Obama's mode of operation, based on the psychology and sociology of his governance. Anything less than a categorical veto of this by the U.S. government, by Washington, and there are, of course, means financially and otherwise. We certainly could hurt and isolate the Israelis even more than they are now. Anything less than a categorical veto, though, is taken, I think, as a green light. There is no such thing as an amber light that works with Jerusalem, and I think the Obama administration may not understand that. You know, they have no one there with any institutional history, no one there with a longer-term perspective on dealing with this very, very troublesome, increasingly independent, defiant, almost hostile client. Our single most important, arguably our most important, certainly one of our most expensive clients in the history of American foreign policy, and in the end, as Bob Baer suggested, they are out of control.
But the people who are speaking out, there's nothing in the American press about this, but the people who are speaking out are the most senior intelligence officials in Israel and the General Ashkenazi, the chief of staff of the military.
Oh, I, and I don't think this is any secret within the U.S. government. It's not being talked about. You're seeing a little bit of ripple effect here in Panetta's remarks in Iraq, talking about the how active the Iranians were in arming the Shiite militia, and then blaming them as direct responsibility for the recent spate of American casualties there. You're seeing more aggressive Iranian actions everywhere. The Iranians are encouraged, of course, by the Arab Spring, because there is a kind of evolving detente between Egypt and Iran. And Egypt, of course, was very crucial in backing the United States in its policy in Iran and certainly in Iraq and elsewhere. So the landscape has changed radically. The one thing that hasn't changed is the administration in Washington, and if anything, it's changed for the worse with the departure of Gates. So yes, the military, the Joint Chiefs may be our last best hope, and maybe they can present a powerful enough case to give Obama cause for being stronger and more defiant in his attitude toward Israel than he's ever shown in the past. He can do this without confronting them publicly, of course. He can do this very much behind the scenes, very discreetly, and can let them know that the United States will not be supporting this. But I'm not even sure, frankly, Ian, that would deter Netanyahu. This is not altogether a rational decision in terms that we would define. I really think that Israel sees itself in an end game. Certainly the right wing, the Likud, does, and end games are, as we know from two world wars and a lot of other crises, end games are unpredictable.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Roger Morris, I'd like to turn to the assassination of Ahmad Wali Karzai, the governor of Kandahar, Karzai's half-brother. Your new book, Between the Graves, about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and covert activity based on thousands of secret documents that you've culled through. I take it it's still in the hands of censors, right, or lawyers?
It's in the hands of Park Avenue lawyers, which is, I'm feared, are almost as bad. This is a gangland killing. It's also an event, obviously, in Afghan politics. He was, in many respects, the second most powerful man in the country, although using the word powerful, and his half-brother, Hamid Karzai, the president, in the same sentence may not be accurate. This is a very splintered, very tenuous regime, as you know. The United States is facing this drawdown scenario over 2011 and 2012, in which my assumption is and my expectation is that the Obama administration will indeed begin a drawdown, a pullout, for as much for domestic reasons as for anything else. But this is a gangland war. He was the one of the largest drug dealers in South Asia. This may, if it doesn't have Pakistani fingerprints on it in some way, I would be absolutely astonished. Kandahar is the center of Pakistani influence politically, and this is bound to have an effect in the next few weeks and months on all sorts of things inside Afghanistan, on the viability of the Karzai government, of the pace at which the modernization, so to speak, whatever one wants to call it, the training and strengthening of the army takes place. This is a disaster. Again, I think Bob Baer was absolutely right. This is a major setback for American strategy. You know, McChrystal's intelligence guy at one point had almost put a price on this man's head. He said, you know, when you're dealing with organized crime, you're dealing with someplace like Chicago, you have to get rid of Al Capone. And the reference was, you know, getting rid of this man who was just assassinated. But then there was a major reversal in American policy. He's always been more or less on and off the CIA payroll, was on that payroll even during the period of the Soviet invasion and civil war and all the rest. It goes back, our ties with him go back 20, 30 years. This is a long and sordid history, but he was definitely our man in Kandahar. He was supplying information. He was helping to mobilize the militia. He was supplying intelligence on the Taliban, and at the same time conducting a drug trade, which was highly lucrative. And we mustn't ever forget that drug trade has connections with organized crime in the United States and elsewhere in Western Europe, who are very powerful forces in American politics. So this is, I think, chiefly a gangland killing, but it will certainly have political effects.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Roger Morris.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Roger Morris, who served on the United States in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His new book, Between the Graves, is about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia, based on thousands of previously secret documents. He's also at work on a comparative history of the inner politics of the United States and Soviet Russia. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with economist David Ruscio. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And I'm joined by David Ruscio, who is a professor of economics at Notre Dame University. His books include Economic Representations, Both Academic and Everyday, Postmodern Moments in Modern Economics, and his latest, which will be out soon, Rethinking Planning, Development, and Globalization, Essays in Marxian Class Analysis. He also writes for the Real World Economics Review blog. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Ruscio.
Thank you very much. The pleasure is all mine.
And I'd like to talk with you about the real state of the American economy, which, as you know, is overshadowed by political gamesmanship between one party that apparently will be rewarded for wrecking the economy and the other that will be punished at the polls for the resulting wreckage. And so let's try and sort through this train wreck and then get to the larger questions of how fast the United States is becoming a plantation economy. First of all,
very quickly.
The answer to that second part is very quickly.
Yes, it is very quickly, but we'll come back to that.
So, how can we get any clarity on this? Because it is so political, and even the politics are fratricidal, not just between the Democrats and the Republicans, but as you know, there's a tremendous rivalry between Eric Cantor and John Boehner, which is the reason why the Republicans can't make a deal.
Correct. I think we always make a mistake when we presume that these political actors, just like economic actors, all are on the same side or have the same interests, right? They're disagreeing about amongst one another. But notwithstanding those agreements, what's happening right now makes absolutely no sense. It's a kind of insanity.
But why did the president buy into the insanity of these people threatening to take the whole temple down like Samson? The idea that the good faith and credit of the United States is up for grabs.
Right.
Why take that seriously?
Well, I don't think it's a political game on Obama's part. I mean, I actually believe politically and economically he thinks he's doing the right thing. I think part of the political analysis of that is Obama, and I live in Chicago, Illinois, so we know Obama from a long time back, is a profoundly centrist politician. And he has defined his public life as a politician precisely in terms of bringing both sides together. So that's, I think, one of the reasons that he bought into this and is engaging in the kinds of negotiations he is right now, basically giving away the store. Economically, he's had an economic team surrounding him from the very beginning, and it continues to this day, that has that economic agenda, that it believes that the problem is a problem of confidence on the part of financiers, and they need to do everything they can, throwing money at them, solving the problem of the deficit in order to, quote, calm the markets. I think it's an insane strategy, but it is the strategy he's adopted from the very beginning. There's no surprise there. So all of the people who are surprised that he's, I don't understand that, in all honesty.
Well, but how did he get into the situation where he's giving away about, if they're talking about the big deal that he's offered, which right. the Republicans have reneged on, apparently mm-hmm. Boehner agreed on it and then changed his mind after he got slammed by Cantor and the Tea Party, the $4 billion deals. But of that $4 billion deals, the best he could have gotten out of the Republicans is to end the tax cuts for the wealthy, which would result in about 800 to 1 trillion in revenues. So
correct.
So there's a ratio here of what Obama's prepared to give away, and in terms of what the Republicans are prepared to give back, is outrageous.
Right. Well, I mean, there are two problems. One, as you noted, is buying into the problem, into the idea that there is a deficit crisis in the first place. Once he did that, once he, Obama, and his economic team bought into that, then I think you have the gamesmanship that is going on right now. Republicans holding the nation hostage, and Obama willing to concede much more than anyone would expect a Democratic president to concede in order to come to an agreement. In all honesty, I think part of that is Obama's own political gamesmanship, offering a lot and having Republicans walk away. That means Obama curries favor with his wealthy backers, but also independent voters. I mean, that's my political analysis. But that's the problem. The problem was to, in the midst of what I tend to call the Second Great Depression, or if you count 1873, the Third Great Depression, it's to even take seriously the fact that the deficit needs to be brought down within the next couple of years. That's insanity. And that's the same kind of insanity going on in Europe right now. The idea that in the midst of, and I think the problem in Greece, Latvia, Ireland, and elsewhere is much more serious in terms of the deficit, the idea that more austerity and privatization are the solution. We're facing the same kind of options here in the United States. It makes no sense when tens of millions of people are unemployed, when they face foreclosures in their homes, when they can't buy goods and services, to even think about cutting government expenditures in order to solve the deficit problem.
Well, David Russia, as an economist, I'm sure you know that if we were back to normal employment, the deficit would go away. It wouldn't be an issue.
Well, yes. I mean, that's only one of the reasons. I mean, in all honesty, the deficit is there for both short-term and long-term reasons.
Right, but we have a revenue deficit problem, don't we? We have a revenue problem, not a deficit problem.
Well, we've got both, in all honesty. I mean, the depression we're in right now both decreases revenues and increases expenditures, right?
Mm-hmm.
So business activity, people unemployed and so on are down. That decreases revenues. On the other hand, more people are, well, they're not on bread lines, but they're on the unemployment lines. They need food stamps and so on, and that increases expenditures. So the depression itself creates a problem, and precisely government expenditures in that situation are what economists call countercyclical, right? They're
right, but
kick in to boost economic activity. So the idea of cutting them makes no sense.
Well, this is what
I would only add to your analysis: two other factors, and that is the wars and the Bush tax cuts.
Well,
in the short term, about 90% of the current deficit stem from those three factors.
Well, that's what's so bizarre, is that Bush Jr. alone ran up about a third of the entire debt of the nation since its foundation, and Bush Sr. and Jr. combined with Reagan is over a half. But the bizarre thing, though, is that 2 out of 10 dollars in the American pocket come from the government, and they're about to take $37 billion out of that this year. So everything that you would normally do in a recession, where the Obama administration is being forced into the Republican strategy of more austerity.
Absolutely.
And that's the part that is incomprehensible. And what he said in his press conference was that, let's make this big deal, and then we can get back to doing jobs. Well, that's exactly the cart before the horse. He should have been talking about jobs from day one,
right,
instead of this ridiculous deal.
Right, and that's become the common sense within Washington, and in all honesty, for somebody like me in economics, it's the common sense within mainstream economics. You would have thought after the crisis, during the continuing depression, that precisely those policies that got us into the problem in the first place, that there'd be at least a bit of self-consciousness, if not a turn to different economic ideas and policies, and in fact as a kind of revenge of austerity. That's what is, for those of us in economics, extremely perplexing.
Again, I'm speaking with the Notre Dame professor in economics, David Ruscio. Some of your recent studies indicate that between January 2009, when Obama took office, and June 2011, with the latest available numbers, total government employment has declined 1.8%, while the decrease for state and local government employment are 1.5% and 2.6%, respectively.
Exactly.
So the truth of the matter is that normally, in a recession and depression, government spending increases, and by extension, employment, government employment. We're on the opposite trajectory.
Exactly. No, that's the incredible thing. Aside from that temporary census hiring last year, government employment at all three levels, at the federal level, the state level, and the local level, are decreasing. Exactly what should not be happening. Now, the stimulus program did, in fact, help some local and state governments keep some of that employment, but that's run out now. So not only has government employment decreased when it should have been going in the opposite direction, at least if you compare it to the New Deal and the Work Progress Administration during the 1930s, it's going in the opposite direction. It's actually shrinking, and it's only going to get worse this fall when tens of thousands of teachers are laid off in school districts across the United States. That's part of the current insanity.
So, David Ruscio, this feels like the kind of medieval analogy that bloodletting or bleeding was to medicine. I mean, instead of staunching the bleeding and infusing the economic body with more blood or energy or capital or whatever you want to call it. I'm belaboring the metaphor here. We're doing the opposite, right?
Right, right. And there's from my perspective, there's a kind of short-termism about it, that those in control are going to get theirs, get it quickly, and to hell with everybody else and to hell with the economy and society as a whole. I mean, that's what's being, I mean, the society is being rent apart by these policies. But those at the top, the top 1% income earners, who now have 20% of the national income, 35% of the national wealth, they're walking away with theirs. And I think the question for all of us is, why is this going on, and what are the implications? If private enterprises cannot, will not generate the jobs necessary, then precisely the government needs to step in, or other kinds of solutions. Somehow we have to be able to get control of some of that surplus in order to create jobs, and that's not what's happening right now.
So here we get back to the plantation economy now.
Right, right. Yeah, with a little bit of a difference. I mean, when Warren Buffett talked about it, he was concerned about foreign owners of U.S. debt. What we have, I agree with the analogy, except for different reasons. I think what we've got is a shareholder economy within the United States. What that means is those in control can dictate the terms under which their tenants take their jobs. Wages actually declined last month. Wages have been stagnant now for 35 years. And the question is, what kind of society does that look like when wages are stagnant, people are working more and more hours, more and more family members are working more and more hours? What does that do to family structure? What does that do to the society as a whole? I mean, a perfect example.
Well, I'm afraid we've got to wrap up here just in the last couple of seconds. Does this mean that Chuck Schumer's right, the Republicans are wrecking the economy in order to profit in the 2012 elections?
They may think that. I actually don't think that political strategy works.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I think people look at that and say, they're on the wrong side.
If you watch
the poll, Americans are wising up to what's going on right now.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today. Notre Dame economist David Ruscio, who is a professor of economics at Notre Dame University. His books include Economic Representations, Both Academic and Everyday, Postmodern Moments in Modern Economics, and his latest, which will be out soon, Rethinking Planning, Development, and Globalization, Essays in Marxian Class Analysis. He also writes for the Real World Economics Review blog. So what did we learn today on Background Briefing? Well, quite a lot. It actually was a mind-blowing experience today to talk to really people who really know that the government have worked in the trenches, particularly in the intelligence world. Robert Baer, the character that George Clooney won the Academy Award for playing in the movie Syriana, spent more time in the Middle East, speaks Arabic and Farsi, really knows the place. We talked about the Arab Spring, all the hope that's embodied in the change there. He agreed that eventually all these regimes would go. We talked a bit about the Syrian regime, but he also warned about how all of the hope and progress could be dashed by Netanyahu attacking Iran, which he says is actually not a bluff. It's a real thing. This is a plan. Already the special forces in the United States have been put on alert to expect this to happen. He believes it will happen. It will happen probably in September before the Palestinian statehood vote in the United Nations. He thinks that Obama will go along with it. He doesn't have the cojones to stop it because he's so much facing an election year, and he doesn't want to lose AIPAC's support. And essentially, Israel does what it wants to do, even though the United States military apparently is terrified. And already Panetta, in his trip to Iraq, talked about how Iran is arming the Shiite militias and how afraid he is of retaliation against us in that part of the world where the United States is particularly vulnerable. So this was a very, very chilling scenario. And I kept trying to pin him down, but basically his source for this, and it's amazing to think that this is not being discussed in the American press, but it is being discussed in the Israeli press. His source for this is the former head of Mossad, Maya Dagan, and the chief of staff of Israel military, General Ashkenazi. They have gone public in Israel warning that Netanyahu's losing it and is going to do this. And they think it's a catastrophe too. And of course, it will be a catastrophe for the United States because we will end up on the wrong side of history. And that will have enormous long-term consequences for us. We've continued the conversation with Roger Morris, who served on the National Security Councils under Nixon and Johnson and quit over the bombing of Cambodia. He's just completed a book, Between the Graves, about the history of U.S. Relations with Afghanistan, both in terms of covert activity and policy, based on thousands of previously secret documents. It's in the hands of lawyers now, but he really does know his stuff. He agreed entirely with Bob Baer and thought that this was really going to happen, and really got into why it is that Obama simply will not be able to stop it. The incredible influence of Israel in with Biden being in AIPAC's pocket, Kerry, Donald, the National Security Advisor, and just generally the idea that Obama's going to just have to go along with it, which is unfortunately the Israeli strategy. They'll just go ahead and do it, and the U.S. will be stuck with the consequences, and clearly would have to join in on Israel's side, which of course will be terribly damaging to prospects for the U.S. Benefiting from the Arab Spring, which will be set back. And then finally, we talk with the great economist David Ruscio. Really interesting conversation about the real nature of the economy, which is totally politicized now and paralyzed by political gamesmanship, but tremendous insight. I really highly recommended you listen to David Ruscio's analysis, one of the best and most cogent that I've heard. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank some of my producers, Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. Our theme music is One Time, One Night by Los Lobos. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.